the June 20th House Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness is now in session. I sent a letter, hopefully you had a chance to get it, at least you have it. It's a reminder of the work groups that we have had so far. It's a recommendation for two work groups I'd like to incorporate into the interim work, and then there's a proposal as a part of it to include a Veterans Caucus in terms of planning during our legislative days as we move forward. Just for the record, to remind folks of the existing work groups that I'd like to move forward, we have the Amateur Radio Structure Systems for Response Recovery Efforts, the ARES piece that's actually being chaired by, or I should say, facilitated by Representative Post, the Citizen Corps and Credentialing, which is facilitated by Representative Parrish, the existing and potential training synergies available at DPSST EM training was Representatives Escoval and Lewis. Airports, Representative Meek, and there's going to be a report actually today about that. I'm looking forward to hearing. Seaports, Representative Meek and Representative Boone, Vice Chair Boone. She asked earlier today to continue this moving forward, so we're going to basically try to have that as a focus again. The Scalable Response Recovery Facilities, I'm going to be facilitating that. The Critical Ground Routes, Representative Lively, I'd like to have you continue that, especially once the transportation plan is, we know where it's at.
Where it's at.
I think that'll be helpful.
That's the goal.
The 911 status and technology horizons, I'm going to be working on that. There's some statutory changes that we may be looking at in the interim that are just cleaning up language, but I want to make sure and work on that. Local government training, representatives, I know Representative Lewis was working on it. I'd actually like to ask Representative Boone. There again, going back to what Texas does, Texas requires entities that are ever going to request FEMA assistance to have at least a few people on staff that have taken the 100 and ICS training. I'd like to continue exploring that if we can over the interim, if that's acceptable to you. And then the two veterans, because we now have the veterans package moving forward, it's got out of the subcommittee. I'd like to establish a veterans outreach and a veterans services work group, and rather than work group in terms of coming up with work, these two work groups are really more about oversight, that as we expand the outreach that was listed in Measure 96 and we expand the services component, that we have very fluid conversations going back and forth to make sure that we're keeping trust, keeping faith with the people. I'd like to propose on this that for the Veterans Outreach, Representative Parrish and Representative Lively both co-facilitate that.
Glad to do that. Thank you.
And Veterans Services, Representative, I'll take that with Representative Lewis, if that's acceptable. And then, of course, Representative Meek, because you're working on some of the other work groups, every member is invited to every single one. We're trying to make sure that you can do the same expert work with your staff on the seaport piece that you did with the airport piece. So that's kind of what we're looking at.
Okay.
If these work groups are acceptable, and I didn't really receive a lot of traffic in emails that they weren't so far, what is plan on those going forward as our set work groups from the committee? There is an additional work group that may come about that has to do with the there was a deal made with the Department of Administrative Services regarding hiring of veterans employment draft language that they were working on, that they were trying to do with BOLI as a policy as opposed to legislation. And as we get closer to 2018, I may ask people to come together to look at that and make sure that it's actually having the effect that we wanted to. The request at the time was to hold off on legislation, see if the rules could work. I said, okay, but my patience is not forever. So I just want to give everybody a heads up that may be brought online, but later in the interim. Okay. So does this work as a work plan moving forward?
Mm-hmm. Sounds good, Chair.
Okay. Well, if that's the case, then we'll just kind of say that's what we're going to do. What I'd like next is, Representative Meek, you have the floor to your team to explain.
Would you like me to come up to the
come forward
presentation there?
Well, he's doing that, just an update. As you know, Representative Meek has been working with a number of folks on the airport piece, including state and federal entities. What he's reporting out today is basically work done so far with some ideas moving forward, and then Hopefully we can actually use his work group to continue the efforts. So, Representative Meek, please introduce yourself and the fella next to you, and tell us what you learned.
Well, thank you, Chair Evans, Vice Chair Boone, Vice Chair Estevel, members of the committee. For the record, Mark Meek, and from House District 40, Oregon City, Gladstone, and unincorporated Clackamas County. And thank you so much for the opportunity to work on the airport resiliency work group. And we did develop three white papers on airport resiliency, and the three white papers were to identify airports as forward operating bases and tier them based on capability, and then prioritize equipment, outline and prioritize the categories of equipment that could be used in a declared disaster, and then identify funding, identify major avenues of funding that could be pursued for airport resiliency efforts. And our work group membership included individuals representing the Department of Aviation, Office of Emergency Management, State Resiliency Office, a Resilience Office, and Oregon Pilots Association. The whole work group met a total of four times, with my office coordinating additional meetings with departments on an as-needed basis. And so white paper number one is to identify the airports, and you will see that I downloaded, if you have your computer, you can pull up the three white papers as additional materials on today's OLIS. But our initial efforts were to identify airports, and you will see that we based them on three different tier categories. Tier one was to considered vital for both rescue operations and economic restoration. Tier two were to provide access to the most rural areas and the need to restore major commercial operations. And then tier three airports will be to provide economic and commercial restoration and major, for the entire region after a Cascadia subduction type of event. And on request by FEMA, the state of Oregon prioritized eight airports highlighted in red, listed right there, and listed in the right-hand fourth column there. And you will also see in blue were three additional airports that were identified by both the chair and a couple of other folks in our committee or work group meeting. And they were added for Oregon to conduct and it's additional assessments on. And so that was our white paper for airport resiliency. Any questions on that so far?
Representative Meek, if I could add just one thing. One of the things that was most impressive about this work group, the way you put things together, is who all you had involved. And I remember Dr. Goldfinger was a part of this conversation, and I want to emphasize that pre-conversation with him on this, there was a belief, or at least the working assumption based on earlier comments, that effectively the airports in the Willamette Valley would be relatively useless after the event. And from what he shared in that conversation, highways and other things may likely be completely messed up like thought before, but there are certain areas that we try to identify that still would likely have more than medium capacity, meaning that there are things we can do to structurally make them more resilient and still useful in that immediate aftermath. So those lists, at first glance, you're like, wait a minute, a lot of them are in the valley. Actually, this was done in conversation with him after the most recent review of what he anticipates being the likely outcomes based on the historical evidence. So I was there's certain airports on there that may have other structural obstacles, but their location, in order to kind of as a flow, was really enlightening to me. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Chair Evans. I want to maybe let my staff know. Let's put a footnote in as in some of our report here that he was somebody that came and provided great input and not testimony, but just support from his very professional opinion that in his research on the coast and the inland areas, that he felt that yes, a lot of these airports in the valley would survive, and that we could potentially do some additional work to help fortify them so that we know that they would definitely survive. But some simple analysis will also give us a better idea, current soil conditions in those areas too. But it does look very likely, and hopefully as we move forward to being more prepared for any type of major event like that, that this starts the process and we can learn more about our capabilities in the future.
Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Meek. So this list is a little different than ones I've seen before, so I'm trying to understand this will survive business, because I've certainly understood the Klamath and the Redmond given their location, and so, and given other airports in the valley, and those in Tier 1 in specific, then we've got Portland and Salem. And so what does it mean they will survive? I mean, at what level or what work would be taken if they, quote, survive to have the operations that you've identified are necessary in Tier 1?
The Tier, well, let me just make sure I qualify that PDX Airport has already been identified as a crucial asset, but I believe that even Dr. Goldfinger would say that he would feel that that would be liquefied in liquefaction and not be.
That's what I wondered about.
Yeah, would not be remaining, but because of its National Guard presence there and the federal funds, that we did have to identify that as a Tier 1 project, just for sheer capacity. But we did also we did move Hillsborough to the Tier 2 because we feel that because of its location and the testimony or the input from Dr. Goldfinger, that that likelihood that that airport would survive may be a crucial avenue to support the metro area in an event like this. So we don't feel that PDX will be navigable or able to provide support.
The piece that was new was some of the new technologies that have been developed in Japan and other places. And survivability, meaning it will take a hit. It won't be the same as it was. Mm-hmm. But, for example, in some of the valley areas, there are new technologies and fortification techniques that can be done so that it is usable before, during, and after. Perhaps not as much, but some utility for both fixed wing and rotor. And that with certain investments, the geography itself will likely not be completely barren wasteland, but that there's a higher risk, but that there are some things that can be done. He actually showcased an airport in Japan that
the Fukushima
was still usable.
That the after the major earthquake and the even the tsunami, that they were able within a week's time to clear that airport, and it was functional, and they were bringing supplies in and out of that airport in Japan.
So in the case of Portland, since it sits on the Columbia, we're far enough up from any tsunami net that the water coming back up the Columbia from a major event on the coast isn't a threat to the airport?
To the PDX airport?
Yeah.
I don't think even Dr. Goldfinger would recommend, and correct me if I'm wrong, Chair Evans, but that it's very, very likely because of the fill that's in the sandy loam type of material that the airport is on, PDX is on right now, that through the shaking major Cascadia event, that it would be dissolved through liquefaction. We don't know necessarily what the National Guard's, you know, what they've done for their ability, but does that answer your question?
Yeah, I'm not questioning it being there. It absolutely is a strategic. I'm just trying to, once we get to the point we start talking about, so how do we, what investments can we make over time to help fortify it? I'm just trying to lay all that out there, but I'm not questioning it. Absolutely, it's a huge, and especially with the Guard and people there, it's a huge asset that we've got to make sure we do something with.
Yep.
I think to follow up on that, that really what looking at this is more of areas that we need, mm-hmm. and that are likely to be able to be upgraded to the point that there's still usability afterwards.
Okay.
It won't be the same.
Right.
The other point that we were talking about is use of naval or Coast Guard air from the Pacific side versus just across the Cascade. So we tried to think in different dimensions on how we could best use the available airspace.
Great. Thank you.
Representative Lewis.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I may be getting ahead of you, Representative Meek, and if I am, I apologize. But I know that the local emergency management folks, Marion County, have identified Aurora Airport as a potential supply drop. They were also looking at the whether or not the bridges are going to be intact. So on those airports, was there any analysis done about bridges and actually access from communities to a supply drop at one of the airports?
No, thank you, Chair Evans and Representative Lewis. The main work that we did for this, for the airport resiliency project, was not necessarily, we're feeling that a lot of the roads may be impassable and that we're going to need to bring logistically lots of material, supplies, evacuate folks, and some of the process may include helicopter airlift, bringing us to the airports. And so we're working off of a worst-case scenario that we're not going to have much access to local communities, or at least that we know will be survivable initially. So that's why we're looking at trying to get to figure out which airports will survive, how do we plan and prepare for that, and then also what kind of resources can we put in and bring from both the federal and state level to fortify them and build them up. Our worst case is that we're not preparing for any land shipments.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. Chair Evans. And so that's basically the majority of the work for the white paper, for the number of the airport, identify airport resiliency prioritization. And number two, then, our second white paper was to prioritize equipment. And so we tried to outline and prioritize the categories of equipment that could be used in a Cascadia subduction zone event. And there are two categories in order of priority as determined by the Department of Aviation. There's stationary equipment located on site at priority airports, and then non-stationary equipment, which includes transportable pallet container, or that some mobile materials that we can transport by palletable containers. And you'll see, I'm not sure if it's listed there, but I will kind of go through here. For example, some of the stationary equipment we're talking about are emergency generators for power, communications for ham radios, VHF radios, satellite. One of the biggest concerns that the Pilots Association brought up is fuel. Fuel is going to be a really big deal. And so if you imagine a lot of our fuel tanks are operated with power. So if we don't have power bringing brought to the fuel tanks, and they're going to be useless. We talked about maybe initially if we don't have generators operating or providing they lose their connections, having hand pumps potentially so that they can initially help just get the fuel in. We're trying to prepare for worst case scenario, and hopefully we're going to be really good Boy Scouts and be ready in the case. So we're prepared for every kind of situation. But we looked at that shelter, hangars potentially that we can help support in different airports throughout the state that would help to shelter equipment and eventually hope shelter folks, et cetera, as needed. Basic life support and sustainment. Lots of that equipment that we feel is important. And then some of the, let me see here. And then as we went down the list here, some of it may be involved with engineering, such as chainsaws, air compressors, pneumatic tools, the such. So if we think about maybe, say, Aurora is one of the No, I better not say Aurora. I better go one of the top. let's say Klamath Falls down there, because the likelihood that any Cascadia event occurs in the next 70 to 100 years through the analysis that Dr. Goldfinger provided, it's very, very likely that that event will occur down by the Brookings Gold Beach area. And a huge catastrophic one will come all the way up to Seattle. So if we are prepared at the Klamath Falls and or Cape Blanco area, if we have, which we're going to do some work on Cape Blanco, but say we have some equipment in the Klamath Falls area, we can hopefully, if we need it in another area, we can allocate it and reallocate it to some of these different airports and prep, you know, to help them do the work they need to do. So. Any questions on the second white paper on equipment? And we're talking about prioritizing. This is a fluid document, and hopefully if you have some ideas, we'd be happy to, you know, work with that. And I was very, very let me make sure I thank the partners, that folks that were involved with my on these work groups, from OEM and the governor's office and the pilots, and there was one more there.
Good. Thank you. So you mentioned places for people to stay, especially if the airports are going to be a place that we might bring you into. And I just wanted to add to the list at some point as we're considering that. I saw a demonstration last summer in my area. There actually were greenhouses, is what they're designed for, but they make wonderful, quickly to build facilities because they're plastic, so they come in kits, and they're plastic pipes and that, and you can put them up in about 2 hours. And now the material that's available on those makes them habitable. They've actually done it, and so their suggestion was, you know, we could station those around in places. And airports makes a great place where you could do that because you'd have the site. We were talking more of the standpoint, other places in the state where we couldn't get people to airports, where these things could be constructed pretty easily and quickly. Versus, and they have a life in some extent more than what the old tents were in that. So it's another, and that, there's people in the state that do that kind of stuff all the time.
No, those are great ideas. And
for the work group I'm working on, one of the goals is to, once we go through a similar system, prioritize rally points, response, and recovery, that there's kits that are basically designated, so flying into the event we know what's on hand and how much folks we can help, versus a few repositories strategically placed where we can basically take from when we need to.
Yeah, so. And one of their suggestions was, given the propensity of the nursery business in the valley, especially north, and many of them have those facilities, and that's exactly right. So if we identified where those are at, strategically located in areas where you could get to them versus even the airports, you could quickly convert those to.
That's a good point.
Thank you. And so the third white paper we worked on was identifying funding. Of course, we'd have some great ideas, but if we can't fund and find some resources to build and acquire the tools we need, we're not going to be able to do anything. So our goal was to identify major avenues of funding that could be pursued for airport resiliency efforts. So the five major areas that we identified were identified by the work group are through the Oregon Department of Aviation, 2015's House Bill 2075, which funds the Aviation System Action Program Fund. There's two components of that could be used for airport resiliency, and one of them is the Critical Oregon Airport Relief, which is CORE. Totaled at $1.7 million in 2017. And it primarily funds projects with FAA math requirements and airports listed in the Oregon Resiliency Plan. So that's why it's important for us to work with some of those airports that have been identified. And then there's the state-owned airport reserve, totaling about $1.5 million in 2017, and primarily funds infrastructure and safety improvements for state-owned airports, particularly the 16 owned airports that don't receive federal funding. And then the second type was grant programs administered by OEM, Oregon Emergency Management, and Business Oregon. And let me see here. Page.
That's right.
There's four grant programs within the OEM process, and that's the Oregon, the Emergency Management Performance Grant, and it makes grants to states to assist state, local, and tribal governments in preparing for all types of hazards. So OEM applies to FEMA for these EMPG funds on behalf of the state of Oregon and its local and or tribal emergency management agencies to determine eligibility. There was $360 million available nationally in fiscal year 2016, and each state has allocated a 0.75% plus a 0.25% for four territories, with the remaining funds allocated to states by population. This means that Oregon has about $5 million available in funds from the EMPG program. And these funds require a 50% match from the state of Oregon, though. So it's buy one, get one free, right? So then number two would be the Pre-Disaster Mitigation Program, PDM. And it is designed to assist states, tribes, and local communities in implementing a sustained pre-disaster natural hazard mitigation program. FEMA makes funding decisions based on agencies' priorities for the most effective use of grant funds and their availability. Each state receives about $575,000 and can apply for up to $15 million in competitive grant funding. So that's actually a really good resource if we put together good plans and we can justify these funds. It's a good opportunity. Number three is the Homeland Security Grant Program, and it's run by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and FEMA. And Oregon currently receives funding for two HSGP programs, the State Homeland Security Program and the Urban Area Security Initiative. In total, these two programs amount to $3.5 million, with 80% of those funds, about $2.8 million, allocated to local governments, while the remaining 20%, which is about $700,000, goes to the state of Oregon. So another opportunity. And then number four is this Fuel Storage Facility Compatibility Fund Program. And it provides funds to licensed public and private fueling stations for the installation of emergency generator connectors at fuel facilities using card lock terminology. The generator connectors will allow publicly owned generators to be connected in times of emergency to provide fueling for life-saving and first responder needs. The fund contains $100,000 that can be granted, and individual grants are limited to $4,000 per facility. I believe there was some discussion with some of the folks in OEM about some of those grants maybe not being robust enough because it's getting money back, getting that type of funds. It's some of the airports didn't apply for them because it was going to be cost prohibitive and they didn't have the matching or other funds available. And then there are two additional grant programs with an application process administered by Business Oregon, and that's the Seismic Rehabilitation Grant Program. And that's a competitive Oregon grant program that provides funding for seismic rehabilitation of critical public buildings, critical public buildings, including and particularly public schools and emergency services facilities. Eligible activities include structural improvements, architecture, engineering, and project management. Applications are evaluated by a statutorily designated grant committee. And then the sixth one would be a special public funds work, public works fund, SPWF. Is that up there? Mm-hmm. You guys seen that all right on the table up there? And it provides funds for publicly owned facilities that support economic and community development in Oregon, administered by the Business Development Department's Infrastructure Finance Authority. And there are three categories of projects which grants may be provided: development projects, planning projects, and emergency projects. Let me see here. And there's much more information on that. And I think finally would be, well, there's a couple more, right? What's that? Okay. Yeah, third would be airport districts. That the group I just talked to you about were all just grant programs for the number two. The number three is airport districts, which may levy ad valorem tax under 0.5% of real market value for all taxable properties. There is one that currently exists, and that's in Coos County. But there also are six port districts and one park district with airports that function similarly, and they can levy additional property taxes at 0.25% of real market value for their areas. So that's potentially another opportunity. And then there's the local improvement districts, which is the LID, and it's an option for local property owners who would benefit from capital improvements to finance airport resiliency projects. So maybe something similar to an Aurora community. And then fifth would be bonding. Three types, major types of bonds that could be used for airport resiliency include the 11Q bonds, most cost-effective and should be used whenever possible, but it's designated for acquiring, constructing, remodeling, repairing, equipping, and furnishing real or personal property owned, operated by the state of Oregon. So it has to be state of Oregon property. Then there's the 11N bonds, which you could use for planning and implementation of seismic rehabilitation of emergency services buildings. And then last but not least are lottery bonds, available through legislative action. So you guys are probably very familiar with all that. And that wraps up the three white papers that we were working on this year. And I once again want to thank all our partners that helped me with their time and efforts and their expertise. And so thank you, Chair Evans, and I'll be happy to answer any of the questions or be happy to be finished.
Anybody have questions?
It's good information.
Okay. Well, seeing none, what I hope happens next, now that we know what we didn't know, is continuing to work to get the assessments on the airports and working with the Department of Aviation and the full partners to figure out on a case-by-case basis what the legislature can do to help either facilitate, push, pull, drag, shout, scream, beg, whatever, our federal partners especially, to try to attack Tier 1 and then Tier 2 and then Tier 3 on trying to come up with plans to make that happen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would just like to add to that, that we collaborate with OSPAC on all that we do, and maybe send them a copy of your presentation here and the other work groups that we have so that they're kind of kept up to speed. Because we always just assume that they're watching us somewhere.
No, thank you, Chair Evans and Representative Boone, or Vice Chair Boone. And also I just want to let my legislative assistant, who did a lot of the typing, working for this white paper, and actually organizing, working with my with the groups, and that's Marcus Siss, my legislative assistant. And I want to give you a chance to just introduce yourself. And there was something we're working on that Neil had recommended for to allow us to help reimburse pilots. Right now they can be reimbursed for certain types of activity if they volunteer their time, reimburse them for fuel use, but in an emergency situation like this, the statute doesn't allow for it, and so that's something we are working on. But go ahead.
Hey, Chair Evans, members of the committee, Marcus Siss, staff for Representative Meek. This airport work group has been a great facilitator of some of these other aviation issues as well, and one of them that Representative Meek just mentioned in reference was something that came to us from Neil White of the Oregon Pilots Association, having to do with an issue with an FAA regulation that does not allow the FAA to reimburse pilots, private pilots, in certain scenarios for disaster relief missions. And so Representative Meek and Chair Evans will be on a conference call tomorrow morning with the FAA and a member of Congressman Trader's staff to troubleshoot that issue. So the Airport Resiliency Work Group has been a great platform and a great facilitator of some of those other aviation resiliency-related issues as well.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Alex?
No, Marcus.
Marcus, sorry. I don't know where I got Alex, but you look like an Alex. I would just add to that, too, if you need any backup on that. There's an organization, American Cancer Society, I think, backs it, but it's the pilots, and they're called Angel Air or something like that. And they have set a precedence, you know, for doing these kinds of things. They fly people to their where they're having treatments, et cetera. And they're all volunteer, but they can get their costs reimbursed. And I think even to, you know, pay them to stay overnight if they have to. But it's each group is its own thing. So.
Well, thank you.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so you mentioned assessment. So we're working on, you know, what we haven't had a chance to talk about yet because I haven't brought it yet is the assessment that's been done on our highway system and bridges. So I assume we're working on the same type of assessment for airports that would provide a list of where we could make those strategic investments.
The Department of Aviation, under their new, relatively new director, who's doing great work, has started a process of, number one, aligning, for example, tiers. There's actually legal definitions of tiers. So aligning what we need to look at both through the federal lens and the state lens and trying to find available funds to target, again, scarce resources but our most important pieces. And he has a passion, given his Navy background, on logistics as well. Mm-hmm. And what I expect to happen after the work group continues its work and gets us into 2018 is perhaps a pilot funding package so that we could outfit one or two of the tiered systems so we can actually point at it, look at it, see what it has, again, based on the assumptions and assessments of the professionals in the field. So that is ongoing.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you very much for bringing that forward. And just to, on the one of the reasons that I think one of the reasons we're trying to work with our federal partners on this is for reimbursement purposes, if you actually have a contract in place with the feds, the standard is they can get up to 100% of reimbursement, whereas if it's after the fact, you'll usually 75%. So trying to help mobilize our public fleet but also our private fleet in being able to, number one, get them paid, but number two, because of that relationship, ensure their availability and their training and everything else is kind of a two-step package. So I think that that's going to be good for everybody involved if we can help the feds recognize that it's in their own interest to make sure that this little we trim a little bit of the statute off and fix it.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Chair Evans, and I appreciate the opportunity to work on this work group.
Great work. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, any other questions about work groups in general? Representative Parrish, I wanted to introduce a couple of things for you. Number one, I'm going to ask that you continue on the citizen corps credentialing, which is good. And then the bottom two, which are new work groups I'm asking us to develop over the interim, one is for Veterans Outreach and one is for Veterans Services. I'm going to ask that you and Representative Lively facilitate the Veterans Outreach piece to ensure that your concerns about nonprofits being able to access the advisory committee process we talked about, as well as that we get those county veteran service officers or campus folks out there as fast as possible. If you're acceptable to that, I'd appreciate it. I think you and Representative Lively are going to be a good team on that. On the Veteran Services side, Representative Lewis and I are going to try to make sure that the programs that are in place are on place and producing the outcomes that have been agreed to.
Let me ask a question on the outreach side, because I think the biggest concern that I've heard from folks who are in sort of that tribal nonprofit space is, okay, we're ready to get ready to do the work. And so, you know, how fast do we think that they will be able to make a financial ask to fund veteran service work? And where will that happen? And how do we ensure that that there's no bureaucratic churn in those dollars?
Anticipating that question is why I asked for the work group to be established.
Okay.
Here's what I mean. Once the budget is formalized, let's say early July-ish, my belief will be by the fall, there will be draft rules as far as how the grants are, again, so for full transparency. The rules developed, identified. I anticipate Director Smith to come back to the full committee and talk about what the rules are. I would be my belief that the work group would actually be involved in helping formulate those rules from the get-go, and that by certainly no later than January 1, but maybe before, grants will have actually been put through the process and at least a few distributed. So my goal is to provide the agency assistance. I'm sure they want it, but nonetheless, assistance with you two working on the outreach side, Rep. Lewis and I working on the services side, again, aligned with the language of Ballot Measure 96, to help facilitate and get out of the way any obstacles bureaucratically that may need to be gotten out of the way of. And my belief is that by having this work group, other entities that sometimes ODVA has to work with, like, let's just hypothetically say DAS or some others, may be more energetic in their support of the outcomes.
Second question. And so the other piece of concern that I've heard from some of the groups is, you know, who gets to sit on that tribal council, if you will, of veterans groups, and that there's a sense that, from their own inside leadership is how those names should get rolled up, where that may or may not be happening right
tribal
now.
Tribal leadership.
More like survivor type tribal leadership, not Native leadership. We have a veterans commission.
Okay. Right.
And there are people on there that represent veterans groups. And there are folks who get appointed by the governor to that position.
Right.
And the concern from some of the organizations I've heard is that that they are not making the recommendation of who they'd like to see representing. It's just somebody who's a veteran, and it happens, and the governor makes that appointment, and they'd like to take some of that authority back. And I don't know where we would do that right away, but
that's a different ask, only because again, for folks that are just tuning in, in fact, the governor doesn't appoint a director. The advisory group does. Mm-hmm. It's one of the few advisory groups in the state that actually has that authority. The governor submits names, and then the advisory group selects. So what I'm hoping to facilitate better collaboration is this work group that can help inform, perhaps, if not structurally, who gets on the board, at least that their case is made in an open way.
Yeah.
So I think long-term, we should look at the structure of that, especially now that they have more of a role. I will say that the amendment that was passed out of Ways and Means Sub, though, the advisory committee at this point still does advise. It is the director that decides now. So they're not the ones actually, they make the recommendations. And I believe at that point, you and your work group will have the greatest influence.
And I think the piece that that I want to honor for those groups is that, you know, all these kind of poobah groups that are out there, whether you're a veterans group or a service organization, there's a lot of work to do to kind of move up the hierarchy of your own internal leadership, and there's a level of sort of dedication that goes with that. So to the extent that those individuals have the ability to say, well, we want to take sort of our best and brightest and most, you know, energized people and make sure that that is representing the face of our service organization.
I anticipate, this may not be realized, but I anticipate now that the advisory committee has more of a structural role in the allocation of resources, perhaps the communication that goes on for the seating of that committee will be a little more robust mm-hmm. than maybe it's been in the past. And I believe that your work group will help facilitate that.
Will save us a bill for February, because we get, what, 3 committee bills?
I think so.
Save us a bill.
So I will look forward to that. And again, my goal is that both of you, and again, any member of the committee certainly can participate, but that you two facilitate the conversation up, get us on time on target.
On time on target.
Okay.
And do.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it would be helpful when this session ends to get a recap of the bills that
yes.
came through and actually got approved with the dollar amount of the lottery funds, so we know how much of that money was
we're working on
how much of that was restored. That would really be helpful. Yeah,
we're working on that.
Okay,
right now I'm still trying to fight for just a little more to put in the pot, but the
second
day,
question. Yeah. I was told today that Oregon Health Authority budget's got, I think it's $2 million or maybe $2.5 million in their earmarked for veterans mental health services.
That's what I'm told.
How is that? I was thinking that we had a bill on mental health as well for mental health services. So how does that work with the ODVA? I mean, how do they know when Oregon Health Authority is providing services and when they don't need to?
I'm glad you asked that, because one of the focuses of the work group you and I are just appointed ourselves to is chasing that down.
Okay.
In terms of the integration of the services. We passed two different bills. One allowed a study of PTSD. There was another rural mental health thing that was right. For veterans. The connector for me is making sure that however OHA currently is planning on delivering services to vets, that identification piece is clear and transparent. And number two, we have visibility on how they're planning to spend it. I think that there are clearly some vets that are vets but won't go to the veteran agencies because of past experiences. That's cool if that's the way it has to work. But I want to make sure that the definition of veteran is in fact targeted on veterans if it's counted as money for that. Having said that, I know that there is a real undeniable belief and recognition that getting mental health care to vets in rural areas especially is not happening right now. So I'm looking forward to see how we make that $2 million plus or minus in OHA coordinated with other services. Because the concern I would have is it becomes a program person or a second program person, but they're not connected to the actual other things going on. Right. So that's going to be on us.
That was going to be my next comment. Yeah. Sure, thank you.
I'll take one in my district.
Yeah, well,
here we go.
And again, you know, if the funds in OHA actually are used to help provide direct service, or if they're quite frankly used to provide transportation to get to an actual vet doc,
yeah.
I don't care, as long as it's linked to make sure that service dividend is larger. So, a great question. And we will get, my word is by at least the first legislative meeting days, if not by the end of session, we will have basically the patchwork of different money that was put in to try to help fill some holes very clear so people know where we're at.
Okay.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, two more things before we go for the day. One is on Thursday, there is the tour of the Oregon Emergency Management facilities. And Bradley, you want to talk about that real quick?
Yeah, thank you, Chairman Evans. Yeah, this is on Thursday, arrive time 2:45, expected to start approximately then to 3 o'clock. I realize you have session from 1 to 2, so there's a little bit of fudge time there. Again, as Chairman Evans says, just go out State Street and you'll see a light down there on Gear Street, I think it is, Greer. Take a left and you'll see it right there.
Big fence.
Yeah, big fence.
The
big
street
fence.
Before Hawthorne.
Big eagle in front of it.
Right, yeah.
Can't miss it.
If you go
got to Hawthorne, you got to the corner of it and turn around.
Sort of UE and then come back.
And we're going to make sure that the security gate has the names.
Yeah, I told Sean McCormick of OMD that everyone in our committee and at least one staff member would appear as well as the Senate vets. I never did get confirmation other than Senator Courtney exactly who from Senate vets would appear, but I told Sean everyone.
Okay. So,
and you need ID?
Yeah, yes.
That just as a reminder for
need
folks
ID.
To have ID.
Right.
I'm not going to be able to come.
So and then,
except for, I mentioned that. Representative
yeah.
Moon probably.
I've been there many times, but I've had a pretty good tour.
Yep.
So I feel good about it. What I want us to do is tour the new building when they get that done.
Yep. We will work that once it's built.
Yeah.
You have an email on the to question to you about the readiness center.
Yeah, okay, we'll track that down. I don't know the answer. It's supposed to. The last thing is next week. We set a day for the party.
We can.
Next week, Tuesday. Tuesday afternoon, evening.
June 27th.
If June 27th works for people.
Is that a party?
Looking around, start around 5:30 or 6. And I was wrong last time on the name, not Heroes, but rather Victory Club downtown.
Mm. Will we be off the floor with the education
budget?
Where is
budget? That? Oh, you'll say
5:30 on June 27th. Saying.
Like I said, 6 o'clock, Not 5:30, 6 o'clock.
Just saying.
Good
just
point.
Throwing it out there.
Thank you. That's what teamwork's for. 6 o'clock.
She was talking about
the
education
bill.
Budget on
so,
the bill
6 o'clock at Victory Club downtown. It's in the Reed Opera House, right behind the Reed Opera House.
Just like that.
And it's owned by vets. They're good people. They have good food, and they have affordable adult frosty beverages for those that can have some.
Been to Air Force people.
Victory House.
Victory Club.
Club.
Uh-huh.
It's a club.
So, questions on that?
What's Victory Club? Is that the surf club?
No, it's a pub.
Pub.
But it's owned by
like
three Marines.
One of the BFW
and
got a bar.
Okay.
Definitely. Army person involved, wasn't
there? Yes, sir, there was.
Okay, I'm just checking.
Three Marines and an Army.
Tuesday.
Yeah, they all wanted to be
Air Force.
Our party.
Sounds like a joke.
Our party on Tuesday.
Three Marines and an Army guy walk into a bar.
Victory just to clarify, so we got it down for the record, the work groups will continue with the folks we talked about. We, of course, included Escobar and everything because he's not here today.
That's right.
We picked up the vets work groups, which we haven't met before, but Parrish and Lively will be one, and Lewis and I will be the other. Everybody, of course, is welcome to be involved. Thursday is the tour. If there's a change on time, obviously we'll announce it from the floor. And then next Tuesday night, 6 o'clock, at Victory Club, which is right near the Reed Opera House for our get-together. Okay, thank you. We're adjourned.
Missing money with twice.
Adjourned.
Missing money with twice.
Okay, thank you. We're